act while on a hike. For NPR News, this is Noha Musleh from Ramallah.
In women's basketball, the WNBA All-Star Game will be held tonight in Chicago at the United Center, where the Chicago Bulls play. It seats more than 20,000 for basketball. This is the league's 30th season. I'm Noora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to The Conversation on WVIK. It's a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Dr. Dave Daynell, a retired faculty member here at Augustana College and a wonderful political scientist. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you will too. So stick around for this week's conversation. Well, Dave, it is a pleasure to see you at all times, and one of my regrets about my age is that my time as a student at Augustana didn't allow for me to have a class with you, but this way I feel like I can make up for it a little bit. Welcome.
Oh, yeah. I'm always ready to give a lecture, so sit back and take notes.
Well, I have had a chance to hear you provide lectures, and I'm going to find out more about your life before Augustana, but I will say that at Augustana, I was always very appreciative of your help. It's one of these little known things in American government that every college and university that receives penny one from the federal government has to observe Constitution Day, thanks to Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia. And he wanted to make sure that that would happen. And you were always a great partner in finding meaningful ways to celebrate Constitution Day, which is coming up September 18th. So I may hit you for some ideas about that.
Right.
Now, when did you start your time at Augustana?
1987.
Okay.
And was there, retired in 2022.
Wow.
And have done a little teaching since then, but yeah.
Yeah, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I need to be delving a little bit more deeply. I know for a fact, and you didn't even need to reinforce it by wearing that beautiful Green Bay Packers shirt that you're wearing today, that your roots are in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Madison, and then we moved to Waukesha, which is in the Milwaukee suburbs, so to speak, and that's where I went to high school. So, and I lived, actually, after we got married, I lived for a couple of years in Eau Claire, too, so I know the state well.
You've been all over the place. One of the nice things about growing up in Wisconsin, at least in my experience of friends, is that no matter what your setting is, urban or rural, you're going to spend a healthy chunk of time outdoors.
Yeah.
What were some of the places you liked to explore as a kid?
Well, in Madison, we had that Arboretum, mm-hmm. and I used to actually be able to walk home from school through the Arboretum. So, that was one of my, favorite things of all time. For any Wisconsinite, the phrase up north is just a statement of where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
of course, mm-hmm. That was part of, my life, getting to go up north every now and then.
And what did that mean for you? Because there's a lot of different iterations of that.
Yeah, I suppose so. For me, it meant the Lake Country.
Yeah.
You get up into the far north of the state, and it's a heavily forested area that has just thousands of lakes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was grateful that, before everyone, I think, knows about the Boundary Waters and a wonderful resource that it is, but before the...
On fire, unfortunately.
On fire, right, that's right. But before the Boy Scouts moved their canoe base there, they used to be in north central Wisconsin.
Yeah, they had two going for a while, Region 7 and Region 10, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both in, one in Wisconsin, one in Boundary Waters. Yeah.
But back in the 40s, my old man was, and in college, he was a canoe instructor at the base in, I think, Trout Lake.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, and so when I was out of college, one time he and I got to go up there and do some canoeing and portaging, and I assume that's the kind of area, Minocqua, Woodruff, Eagle Harbor, all that kind of stuff that you're talking about for just beautiful places.
Yeah,
beautiful places.
You bet.
And of course, to this day, my family still goes up to Escanaba, where we look across at Door Peninsula, and every year I think, man, I got to get out there sometime. Yeah. Do you ever do any exploring out in the Door Peninsula?
Oh yeah, we've you know, spent a lot of time on Door, and it's appealing in many ways. You know, I mean, it has a kind of a local culture of people who, oftentimes retirees who went there and just, you know, want to kind of live a cultural existence as well as a natural one, and so it's a nice combination.
When you were in high school, what were the subjects that caught your fancy? Was it, were you interested in politics and government early on, or was it?
Yeah, history especially, but I think that was, you know, the one that really jumped out for me. Economics was a required course, and I just loved it. At some point in high school, I had grown up, I wanted to be an astronomer. And at some point in high school, I said to myself, you know, what you're actually good at is social studies more than natural sciences. And that kind of redirected my life from that sort of realization in high school.
What about activities outside of the classroom? I'm always fascinated to find out what people did that again, caught their fancy.
Yeah, well, I was a debater.
There you go.
And it took me some years to get over that. I, you know, as a teacher, it doesn't work. You know, the students are far too sensitive, and rightly so, really. I mean, I'm up there with all my power and everything. And I had to, you know, really learn not to deploy my debating tendencies. You know, there's a old legendary thing of the, you know, the Kingsfield method of teaching law school, right? Mm. This inquisitive Socratic method. Mm-hmm. And you really can't just dump that on undergraduates. It doesn't work. And and so I had to sort of get over my debate past as I learned to be a better teacher.
Well, I don't think he would mind telling me telling this story, but we had a president once at Augustana who was a debater in college. And one of the things that I tried to impress upon him is that he was not on the clock, and because he was trained as a debater to get all those points out as fast as possible. And I said, no, well, now you're just trying to move people. So it's okay to slow down and put a little intonation and up and down. But he was also an outstanding lawyer. So, you know, to be brisk in an argument was a part of it. So I can see what you're saying, needing some time to get out of that.
Yeah.
So so for college, undergrad, Wisconsin?
Yeah.
And Madison?
Yeah.
And then where did you think about economics as a major? Or where did you wind up?
I did major in econ and poli-sci. I really started in economics and got recruited into poli-sci. I took some poli-sci.
Well, tell me that. How did that happen?
Well, there's a man who had a very important influence on my life named Charles Anderson, who was a professor of political science at Madison, and he took an interest in me and, you know, asked me to come to his office and took me out for a walk around campus and sold me on political science. And it was, you know, very, I was, you know, quite taken back, really. I mean, to have a professor at a, you know, this big, huge institution,
yes,
right?
Huge.
With 40,000 undergraduates and, you know, to have this, kind of relationship. Hmm. And, I was receptive to it, I enjoyed poli-sci, and my economics, I would say I was more interested in sort of iconoclastic economists than I was in mainstream economists. Mm-hmm. And so that, grad school might've been a rough go actually in econ for me, but, I made that shift into poli-sci, and it was, never regretted it.
Master's and PhD at Wisconsin?
At Minnesota.
Oh, in Minnesota. So tell me a little bit about what was your dissertation for your master's? What were your areas of interest?
Yeah, well, as an undergrad, I loved constitutional law. Mm. And I thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool to teach this. and so I was leaning toward that area for specialization. I was interested in many other things as well, in American politics generally. Mm-hmm. And I got very interested in a theory of party dynamics, the shifting coalitions that make up our political parties. It was one thing that's sometimes called critical election theory. And there were some interesting new pieces that had come out applying that to the Supreme Court. You know, how does the Supreme Court respond to shifts in the party coalitions? Mm-hmm. And that's what I wrote my dissertation on then, was that just that thing. And so it was a combination of both American politics parties, the political party system, and Supreme Court.
Well, good thing you got it all settled back then, because there's no currency to that today.
Right? Yeah, no, it's you know, writing about and reading about party polarization and the Supreme Court is a very interesting thing, and it was not the thrust back, you know, when I was in school. The parties were not that polarized.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was a very different environment.
Yeah. Clearly. And we'll get into those changes in that environment in a little bit, but I'm a little bit chronological. So did you start teaching and then go after the PhD or concurrently, or how did all that fold?
I didn't really do any teaching. No.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the master's degree in some PhD programs is kind of a punishment. You can go straight to PhD, or you can get a master's and go on. And you know, for really the master's was a kind of like, well, you've got to prove yourself now. And so, you know, I went through that hoop before going on, but the plan was always PhD.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, I mean, you know, and back, especially back in those days, graduate school was not about preparation for teaching. You know, it was about preparation for scholarship.
Sure, sure.
And so I'd always been inclined to be a teacher, but then when I ultimately got a job at a liberal arts college, that was really a very different world. Yeah, I had a lot of adapting to do.
And we'll get into that too, but just before we move any further, when it comes to the annual Wisconsin-Minnesota Paul Bunyan football game, I mean, any torn feelings there, or all Wisconsin?
Not at all. I rooted for the Badgers right through graduate school. I even went to, you know, Gopher hockey games and was the only Badger fan in the stadium, so it was...
That's tough.
Yeah, that was tough.
All right, so we've got the PhD right into teaching, and where did that take you?
Well, I started my teaching... I taught a little bit at Minnesota, but I started my teaching career at NIU, Northern Illinois
really?
University in DeKalb. Yeah. And I taught there for 3 years while I sort of finished my PhD, my dissertation.
Yeah.
And you know, I learned a lot there and enjoyed the faculty and the students. After I had kind of served my term there, I was ready to get a permanent tenure track position and was very fortunate that this job at Augustana opened up.
Now, who were some of the, I'm trying to remember who the players would have been in that department when you came on board.
It was Jim Winship and Harold
Winship,
Bell.
Sure.
Jim was really one of the, I don't think I've ever known anyone who knows more about politics than Jim Winship.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was a great commentator for local TV, local newsrooms. He was wonderful.
The story I tell on him, though, is that he wasn't a great administrator, and that's that's why they ended up hiring me. Okay, so the job search happened rather late in the year.
Yeah,
and it was too late for me to do a classroom demo.
Sure,
and I think that worked in my favor.
Oh, that's great. You mentioned this difference in teaching styles. I'll just tell you that when I was still in high school at Rocky, one of my very good friends was bound for University of Iowa and said, hey, would you come with me? I'm doing my campus visit. So I just came along having fun, right? And I just remember we sat in a room that was bigger than any of the theaters at the old cinemas out in Milan. It was huge. And we were like in the next to last row because we had come in after it started. And I just said, well, is that the professor down there? Because it looked like a pretty young person. And our guide said, oh, no. You're not going to get taught by a professor. That's what's called a teaching assistant.
Yeah.
And I thought, because I grew up on Augustana's campus. And like Ambrose and places like that, it's like the PhD is the person who's in front of a smaller group of people teaching. So tell me about your adjustment that you had to make becoming a professor at a liberal arts college.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, it was very different experience than my undergraduate and my prior teaching. Although, fortunately, at Northern Illinois, I didn't have to teach to the 200-300 type classes. They were good sized, but they weren't that large.
Yeah.
But it was, it was novelty for me because, like I said, graduate school wasn't training in teaching, you know, it was training in scholarship. And so we were kind of thrown into the water on a sink or swim basis, really. The great thing was that the senior faculty here at Augustana were tremendously supportive. I mean, I could list a bunch of names who took an interest in me, were incredibly tolerant of this young whippersnapper, and, just really helped me get my feet on the ground here here at Augustana and to be able to get going and develop my skills.
The notion of your interest in constitutional law, which is that's fortuitous because that's going to be part of any undergraduate political science curriculum. But what about those areas where you found yourself having to teach beyond that passion?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that's always been really my favorite thing about teaching in liberal arts college, or one of my favorite things anyway, is that you do have opportunities to teach a lot of different things. And I've, over my career, have been able to get outside even of poli-sci, right? And I was able to do a lot of co-teaching with people from different disciplines. And that's always been, you know, a great thing from my point of view. I loved it.
Well, we'll come back to some of these other issues in a little bit, but I know I want to dive into, you and I haven't had a chance to visit for a while, about what's going on. We just had a chance to go on an alumni trip. We led a group of people over to Sweden, and a lot of my Swedish friends and family members are asking the same thing. What on earth is going on? So when I speak to you as a political scientist, I mean, what sort of precedents? Are there any precedents for where we are now? I mean, we're at a point of almost a nadir of trust, and an acme of corruption. To what do you ascribe this?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I had an answer to it. I certainly do think there's not a lot of precedent. I mean, we've brushed with various problems and issues over the years, for sure. But the kind of sum of what we're dealing with right now is different. And you know, I know we're going to talk about the 250th,
mm-hmm.
But it comes in this context. One of the things that's striking about me is my own personal ambivalence about it. That, you know, I love my country, but I'm not alone in this, feel deeply alienated from my government. And so that sense of ambiguity is new to me, you know, in all my years of, my long years of paying attention to politics.
I hear what you're saying. I sense something similar in my own life, and I've always tried to keep ambivalence at more than arm's length. I like to be engaged. I like to be the passionate side comes along in the wake. But I notice too, I mean, increasingly, I'm like, well, I am very concerned about this, and especially what it will mean for my children and my grandchildren. But then again, that's largely going to be their task, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to seem like that generation that screwed up the environment and said, well, here you go, kids.
Yeah.
Because a lot of good things were done, I should say, for the environment, thanks to regulation in the 70s and so on and so forth, all of which is being dismantled now. But I hear what you're saying, Dave. I I feel like I'm in a bit of a struggle against ambivalence myself. And I'm not yet ready to go quiet into that good night, but I can smell that hay in the barn. We'll just put it that way. But America 250th. I don't think it makes any sense to try to predict what's happening in America because there was no real equivalent to this. There have been other democracies, other attempts at this. Ours is unique, the way we've set it up and the way we've employed it. Even, I mentioned in the promos for today's conversation, de Tocqueville, he was about, what is it, about 60, 70 years into the experiment, somewhere in there, and maybe not that much, but he has no idea where this is going to go.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know how we can, but he did have some observations that I think are kind of cogent today. We're constantly, we have these dualities, right? We have this prosperity and it gives us a means to the ambivalence or something. But there's also the disparity or duality between our desire to follow the founder's high ideals and our susceptibility to hucksters. And I think he hit on that too. So there's these constants. What thoughts come to your mind on the, what is it now? The semi-decent, I can't even think what is that. The
semi-quincentennial.
There it is. Thank you. Thank you. Semi-quincentennial. Got it.
I think that's right.
Yeah, it works for me.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a big question. I think the point you make about the founders is an interesting one. They obviously did a great work.
Oh yeah,
and it's you learn a lot by studying them, and yet we live in a completely different world. And you know, there's no way to directly translate their political theory into practice in our environment. It's a completely different environment, and they were asking different questions and therefore coming up with different answers. And so I think it's great to celebrate. I think we should not miss them, we should, in the sense of, oh, I wish we could, go back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not even, remotely possible or even desirable, right? I mean, we after all, have achieved some the things that they could not. We were able to end slavery in this country and therefore make their ideals closer to real. Real existence than they were able to do.
Right.
And that really goes, right to the 250th, right? And Thomas Jefferson, drafting the Declaration and wanting to, put in there that the king has forced slavery on us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Southern states saying, no.
Yeah, right.
Don't want
right,
that
right,
in
right,
there.
Right, right.
Take that out. We're willing to blame him for slave revolts, which was a stretch,
right,
to say the least.
Right.
But so that,
Well, we've long been malleable, and we're going to talk about that more in just a moment. I'm just really grateful for this opportunity to think about these things with my guest this week, Dr. Dave Daynell. We're going to be back in just a moment as the conversation continues on Quad Cities NPR, WVIK. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for WVIK comes from J.P. Morgan Chase, serving the people, neighborhoods, and businesses of Iowa for over 35 years. More at jpmorganchase.com/Iowa. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A. Member FDIC. And WVIK operations are also partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council. And support for WVIK also comes from the Genesius Guild, offering a public performance in Rock Island's Lincoln Park of Aristophanes Women's Festival, a classical comedy that critiques traditional gender roles with the use of parody and slapstick humor. More information is at genesiusguild.org.
I'm Linda Manning from Bettendorf, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Well, welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK. And this week, it's a conversation with Dave Daynell, a political scientist and someone whose opinions and observations and insights I have long been very captivated by, as I am already this morning. So we're talking about this phenomenon of thinking about founders. And, you know, when in the context of the Supreme Court, there's often a lot of talk about sort of originalist thinking. What were they thinking and how do we translate that to today? I agree with you entirely that you can't do that because the world is not the world the founders lived in. But it really came into sharp focus recently in this year's most recent decisions. The two decisions is like appointments and the power of the executive there, but then also this birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
And the same justices were like, well, we really have to hew to this philosophy here. Oh, now what philosophy was that again? I mean, it was like they had no idea what they were talking about. What are your thoughts on this most recent Supreme Court session?
Yeah, I mean, the birthright citizenship thing, you know, is it's an interesting one in that regard about intent of the framers, you know, because the first thing you look at is the language, right? The language of the Constitution. And it's very clear on birthright citizenship. There's just no mistaking it. And you can go back historically and say, well, they weren't, you know, talking about illegal immigrants. And of course, that was true. And for one thing, of course, immigration was wide open back then. So it wouldn't have ever come up. And that's one of the problems, right, is that the stuff that we're struggling with didn't even come up at the time that those words were written. Now the focus was of course on the freed slaves and making it clear that those freed slaves were indeed citizens not only of the United States but of the states in which they were residing, and that was the southern states didn't want them to be citizens, and so that you know was an important move, and that was their focus of attention, but the language they wrote was general. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the issues that we have today weren't on the table at all. I think of the similar thing about the removal power, the president's mm-hmm. power to remove people in executive offices. And there's a historical case to be made that the president should have that power. And what's happened is that, especially throughout the early 20th century, as the federal government's roles expanded far beyond anything the framers ever contemplated, we started regulating food and drugs. We started, you know, regulating the environment. We started regulating the securities markets, you know, things that were just never even contemplated, right? And as we did that, Congress started setting up these commissions, right, that had a degree of independence from the president. And so then, you know, Donald Trump wants to fire people for political reasons, you know, reasons that people that just don't agree with him. They haven't done anything wrong. They haven't done anything outside their duties. But he wants to fire them. And this is something that presidents haven't been doing since the 1930s because Congress put restrictions on the president's removal power for many of these officers in these commissions. You know, you can say, well, geez, that's contrary to the framers. And of course it is. They never heard of the Securities and Exchange Commission or, you know, or the,
right.
the, you name it. And that's all true, but it's ignoring the fact that we created these commissions in response to the vast expansion of the, federal government and its roles. And we actually, have given these commissions a degree of kind of quasi-legislative power. And in so doing, Congress had concerns, but they felt the need to do it. Congress cannot regulate all things in detail, and the current Congress can't regulate anything. You know,
they haven't done anything.
But even before that, you know, Congress was still a somewhat functional body, they knew they needed help, right? And that's why they created these commissions. And so it's a whole different world. Again, you know, it's a completely different world. And to say we're going to go back and apply a theory of the unitary executive, you know, which is a framers-based phrase, And of course, what it was about was that some states had dual executives back in 1787. And the founders felt that those didn't work very well. Hmm. And they didn't want that. And good. I mean, I'm fine. I think they made the right call.
Yeah.
But, to translate that principle and say, well, now we're going to suddenly adhere to it after not adhering to it for 100 years, it's sold as being somehow objective, right? You know, it's not political. We're just doing what the founders want. Well, not so. You know, in order to take these 250-year-old ideas and apply them in the present, you have to make all kinds of judgments which are inevitably political. Mm-hmm. And so, it's sold as an objective way of interpreting, but I find that dubious.
I want to come back to your notion of ambivalence, and I'll give you an example of what I was trying to illustrate before, but let's just think about the replacement of a deceased senator, Lindsey Graham, within about 15 minutes, it seemed. I mean, it was within a week. I mean, there's somebody there because they need the votes, right? And then just recently, there was a House vacancy, and Speaker Mike Johnson, same party as the Senate desperately afraid that information related to Jeffrey Epstein would come out and tarnish the president, as if he needs any tarnishing, and stalled that and slow walked it for so long. And there was a time when that disparity in the application of rules, right? Yeah. I'm a rules follower for the most part. I think there's some people listening now who might guffaw, but I see the value of those, right? In making anything run, whether it's the Rock Island County Board, a small liberal arts college, a classic Greek theater in Lincoln Park, you got to have some rules and some boundaries and things. And just that sort of capricious application of those rules. Where it comes to that ambivalence is, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I would have been incensed. And as I was around the treatment of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, all this kind of stuff. Now it's just like, well, what do you expect? Yeah. And that's where ambivalence, I think, is a danger for me. How does it apply to you and your outlook on things like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you wonder how do you respond? Because, when you make an argument about inconsistent application of rules, you're trying to make a sophisticated argument. You're making an argument that has some moving parts to it about, you know, what is important, getting what we want right now, or is it also important, is it not also important that we have norms in place that serve as guardrails and direct us in a broad sense, not always in ways that are convenient, you know. And I find that we really have a hard time dealing with anything that involves that kind of a sophisticated argument right now. That, I want this, you want that, I have the votes, I get it, is kind of about all we've got.
Yeah, and to the devil with the consequences, right? Not to think over the horizon. But when we think over the horizon, we often think forward. But here on The Conversation on WVIK, we also look at the horizons behind us. And for that reason, we take a step aside every week at this time. It's time for a beloved former colleague, both of Dave Daniel and mine, Dr. Roald Tweet, and this week's episode of Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Once upon a time near Rock Island, there was a hardware store that did not take American Express. It didn't take Visa or MasterCard either, it took cash. And what it did with cash is an amazing story. Hanson's Hardware in Davenport was an old-fashioned store. It sold real hardware. The hardest hardware, hammers, nails, hinges, and soldering irons, were on first floor. And the softest, waffle irons, kitchen strainers, and women's utensils were on third. What made Hanson special, however, were the miniature trolley cars that took your money and returned your change. You would give the clerk a $5 bill for your 98-cent screwdriver. She wadded the money into a small, oblong metal lozenge and sent it up toward the ceiling on two wire tracks. Zip, it would turn right angles near the ceiling.
whiz past the saws, vices, and the crowbars, turn the corner at the rakes, and continue along until it suddenly turned again and disappeared up through a hole in the ceiling, toward some unseen cashier in a cage high above. In less than a minute, the little trolley would drop through that hole, trace its way back, and drop into the clerk's hands. Inside would be $4.02. You could hear it coming ahead of time if you listened to the wire tracks. On busy Saturdays, many money trolleys would be rising and descending at the same time, but none ever got caught in the traffic. How did each of them know which was its own exact stop? While girls were up with their mothers looking over bread knives and dads talked over repair projects by the plumbing fixtures, boys would stand and watch the trolleys, more fun than their own electric trains, wishing perhaps that they could just once be as small as the acorn-headed brownies in the funny papers and ride the disappearing wires. The trolleys and their whines and clicks are gone the way of cash. Hanson's has moved to the mall, where Visa and MasterCard machines give out ominous beeps and buzzes as they check your perhaps overextended credit. Wouldn't you gladly pay cash if it would bring the trolleys back?
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we always want to remind you that the reason we get to share in Rock Island Lines each and every week here on WVIK is because folks just like you take a moment at WVIK.org and click on that donate button. Doesn't have to be a huge amount, but every little bit helps, especially as what are the implications of this massive renovation of the federal government is there's not really any government support for this radio station anymore. So anything you can do, friends, would be most helpful. My guest is Dave Daynell, and we were just talking about some of the things that go into keeping an eye on what's happening in government. So I'm going to ask for some tactical and practical advice, Dave. How do you keep tabs on things? I mean, I like to read The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, just their daily briefs. And of course, I listen to NPR. But how do you keep tabs on things?
Well, that's, not very dissimilar. I subscribe to New York Times. And I also have a email access to something called the Brookings Brief.
Comes out of
the Brookings Institution and provides this expert the current research really on current problems, current issues and so on. And then, those are my two favorites. You bet. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about some sort of specific things. I want to go macro here for a little bit, but I just recently stumbled across an episode of Nova, the wonderful PBS series, which is usually more science-oriented. And this one caught my eye because it was about democracy in Athens. I'm like, well, that's history. That's politics. And so, but no, it was there was a scientific angle. A team of researchers was trying to recreate the machine that was used to randomly select every legislature at least in the period, the couple centuries of democracy in Athens. And that was, I didn't realize that. I just sort of, assumed that there were some kind of elections. That's not the way that it was set up. I mean, the 10 districts put forth people on a daily basis, whether for juries, but then on an annual basis to serve in legislative and really judicial roles. I mean, that's just fascinating to me. And there's a lot of value to it. But I do also understand that I think any system you come up with, it's just a matter of time before humans manage to manipulate it. But I was fascinated by that, and I don't think it's practical, but it's...
Yeah, that's really something, isn't it?
But I mean, the goal was to protect the city from the oligarchs, from people taking advantage of the system. And to do that was to put in constantly rotated, disinterested, well, no one's completely, but a cast of characters. And I just thought that was fascinating how far we've gone from that.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, one of the things is that we're really wrapped up in meritocracy in ways that I think are quite damaging, actually. And so this idea that, you would just randomly select somebody, to have public office, to hold public office, just strikes us as completely off the beam. But question that we have to ask ourselves is, how much sense does it make to have a process which can be manipulated and is, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that, we imagine, we have this imaginary meritocracy in our head that really it doesn't actually have a lot of resemblance to real life. And yet, so we would just pull back from something like this in that way, I think.
Yeah, and that comes, you mentioned New York Times. There's a piece in there about the fellow who just won the Republican primary for governor of Colorado. And he'll tell you how flawed he is. He mm-hmm. likes to claim that he has killed people, that he has acted in extrajudicial manners, that he has engaged in all manners of illegal behavior. And yet the Republican Party of Colorado thought he was the apex of the meritocracy in their party for governor. And I just don't get that.
No, well, of course I don't either. But that's quite bizarre.
But how do we, as individual citizens, lacking this sort of classic Greek method, what are some of your tactics and strategies and then encouraging others to be engaged productively in rebuilding these guardrails?
That's a great question. I don't have good answers to it. I mean, I have in my own sort of constructing, my daily life really is partly in response to what is happening and what's being done to our common efforts through government, in that I've felt a real compelling mood push to volunteer. Right?
Yes.
And
you do a lot of that. So please, if you don't mind, tell us some of the things you do, because I know some of these, but I don't know all of
them. Yeah. Well, okay. So I've Augustana Connection. I teach courses and support the program in other ways. Our Augustana Prison Education Program, which is definitely a clientele that gets neglected and shouldn't be. And don't get me started, right? And I also do things like food banks and the evening meal that is served at Rock Island Township. Mm-hmm. I did volunteer work at the shelters, the temporary shelters, which were put up. It's as a Christian, I feel, an obligation to serve. And so that really, when Trump started doing things like eliminating USAID and putting restrictions on food stamps and Medicaid access. And, and I felt like, really, I mean, no, you can't just sit still.
Right. Well, you now just touch into one of those dualities that I think de Tocqueville brought up for us. There's one side of the American populace that is takes engagement with the civic realm very seriously, even if it's volunteering at a food bank or anything like that. And then there's another that's content to be maybe rent seekers, and they don't have to do as much. They've arrived, they've gotten it. I hope you get yours, but I have no role in that. Yeah. And that brings to mind another duality, is that he spent some time looking at Cincinnati and Coventry. I mean, between Ohio and Kentucky on the Ohio River. Here we have this instance, and I know by constitutional law, you think of the U.S. Constitution, but every state has its manifestation. And what is a constitution but a way of delineating and defining what the government is going to do for the individual and yada, 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 or not do. And here we have this incredible duality between Iowa and Illinois. Two states have decided very different things. And one says the government should only tell you what you can. And, well, I'm not going to get hyperbolic, but the government can be intervening in things like education and all this, but not so much with hunger. Mm-hmm. And then you have a state over here in Illinois that says, well, it's actually kind of wrong to ban books. So if you're a library that does that, we'll cut off your funding. And we'll find ways to continue those food stamp programs and other things like that. And that's a byproduct of our federalist system. Is it only going to get worse? I don't know.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I do feel like we're, and I'm not alone in this, is really struggling in having even not only just conversations about what we should do as a whole, as a community. And, you know, we, you know, nobody likes to pay taxes, but, you know, I pointed out on Facebook a while ago that, you know, I pay very few taxes. You know, I said, this is, you know, the tax laws are written in my favor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, some, you know, former student of mine, very conservative, said, well, I'm sure the government would like to, you know, make donations. And, you know, and I said, well, you know what? Of course I make donations, not to the government.
Yeah.
The government and taxation is for collective action. It's the way, the really the only way that we can, as a society, agree this is worth doing and we're going to do it together because there's no other way to do it.
Right.
And we've, you know, we don't know how to even have these conversations these days. And that's certainly very, very worrisome. Yeah.
Well, the notion of now, and I do find this very fascinating just from an historical lens, is that Trump is trotting out the old "they're commies," you know, line, because there is a way to power in America through fear, and it's been one of the more effective ones. McCarthy used communism, and now here we are 70 years later, and he's bringing it back.
Yeah.
But others have been people of a different race, people of a different religion, national origin. I mean, it's a rotating cast of characters. And I find it intriguing that the best way, the shortest path to overcoming that is the things you're doing. Get involved in your local township hall and a meal site, or get involved in a housing program. I mean, Lord knows we got a lot of those. Or refugee resettlement, which is another great one.
Yeah.
Sadly, on that regard, the leader of World Relief, which is an amazing local organization, came and spoke to the Rock Island Rotary and noted that in the current year, the only refugees that are being admitted into the United States are white South Africans. Yeah. Who, and this tests another principle. We've always said, okay, you can declare yourself to be a refugee, but we'd like to see some evidence of how you're being persecuted. And the precedent here is that white South Africans will admit we've not been persecuted, but we see it coming.
Yeah.
We think it's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I find that to be very troubling and iconoclastic, again, like that. But okay, so we've gotten into some some macro issues, some micro responses. when you're not talking politics, Dave, what do you like to do? I know some of the answers to that question may involve a paddle, but what are the things you like to do around town?
Yeah. You're right. I do play pickleball.
Hey, good.
Yeah. You know, and I have to just add,
please,
to what you were saying, that at our church, it's a wonderful place, and we have the big, really, growth of our congregation in the last 4 or 5 years has been refugees,
mm-hmm,
from Burundi and from Myanmar, and they're wonderful people. They're contributing to this society in so many ways, and to our community at the church. And my wife got to participate in a wedding, African wedding, that through a connection we have with some of the people at church. And that was a whole new thing for her and for us, and just wonderful stuff. So that, you know, I had to mention that.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. We're getting close to that period in the program where I try to pick people's brains for tips. I've got to give one. Go and see the Odyssey.
Yeah, sounds
and
good.
And even, I mean, a cheapskate like me, it was hard to reach in and grab the extra like $6 it is for IMAX, but do it. That is an experience. And it really reminded me, for WVIK listeners of a certain vintage, Wooten once rented out the Parkway Theater in Moline. It's no longer there. It was in the South Park parking lot for a big screen showing of Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, that movie, you know, you don't feel like you've just been entertained. You know, you feel like you've been swept away in mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really felt that very often, but you do in this movie. It's just really good.
Yeah.
And I don't think you need a deep steeping in the Iliad, the Odyssey, and so forth, but there's some references in there, kind of helps.
Yeah.
So that's my big tip. Do you have any tips for us, Dave?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I have read some good books. I'm in a book club that is sponsored by Project Now,
mm.
And we recently read one called The Second Chance Club by Jason Hardy. And, you know, the basic point, he is a parole officer in, or has been, a parole officer in New Orleans. And they deal one-on-one with people who are at the margins, is putting it mildly, right? And, you know, the thing that just keeps coming through is that we invest the least in the people who need the most. And I think that's that's an important message that we need to think about. And that book is one way really to experience that a little bit.
One thing I want to look into more is there was, I'm not sure what agency it might have. I'm not sure who was the lead agency, so I don't want to give the wrong info, but they looked at how much money is spent in Scott County on about seven individuals and how that might be more equitably spread in terms of housing the unhoused and finding solutions that are enduring. Your book recommendation reminded me of one that we read here at our little book club a while back, How to Read a Book by Monica Wood, because it involves taking books into prisons is one thing, but that was a really good one. And I'm still struggling my way through Queen Esther. Every time I turn around by John Irving, there's something else that's capturing my fancy. But any other suggestions or recommendations?
Yeah, you know, that's this thing about books in prison, a great thing. This part of this book club is that we do a video link with the Kewanee Life Skills Center, which is a prison.
Mm-hmm.
And the inmates there participate with us. And not only that, but we're actually, for the second time now, we're going to have one of our sessions at the prison, in the prison. And, you know, that the humanity, the talent that you see among these men is just truly remarkable. So great stuff. But,
well, tying together a couple of threads, Kirsten Day, a professor of classics, was just on a podcast with one of her former students at the prison in East Moline, who has now been freed or completed his sentence and is pursuing graduate studies. And they're on this national podcast talking about trauma in the Greek classics, right? And it's just a very deep and wonderful conversation. If we had a big website, I would try to come up with ways of sharing that with everyone, but I'll share it with you, Dave. No worries about that. I just can't thank you enough for spending a little time on a Bix weekend, of all things, to chat about these sorts of things.
And not a runner. It's okay.
Same here. No, I run Chasing the Grandchildren So the Children Can Run. How about that?
There you go.
But that's going to have to do it. I'm very sorry that we've run out of time, but thanks again to my guest, Dave Daynell. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it very much.
As did I. And remember, friends, you can catch The Conversation twice each week on WVIK. Of course, Saturday morning, live at 10 o'clock, right after, or rather before, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Then there's a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You're also going to be able to find recent episodes at wvik.org. Just look for us under the podcast tab. Well, from the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on WVIK. I'll give you a little bit of a preview. We're going to have two guests, which we almost never do, but we'll make an exception for Dr. Margaret Farrar and Dr. Adam Call, two scholars who have studied Bishop Hill, Illinois, and they've written a book called Becoming Utopia. I hope you'll enjoy it. I think I will. We'll see what happens when we have that conversation next week on WVIK. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK comes from Impact Life, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information about the need for blood products and services at bloodcenter.org.
I'm Julia Sears from West Davenport, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Take the world with you, with news from around the world and right here at home, 24 hours a day. We're WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240DZ Dubuque. Thanks for listening.